You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eurythmy Therapy, translated by Alan Stott, and it is Collected Works, Volume 315. This is Lecture 1, given in Dornach on the 12th of April, 1921. During these afternoons, I wish to present the first seeds of a eurythmy therapy. Today I will give a kind of introduction. What we gain from it will be developed into definite forms over the next few days, First of all, I would draw attention to some basic matters. What has been practiced hitherto is eurythmy as an art. As such, it should be accepted along with educational eurythmy suited for children, since what has been developed until now as eurythmy is in every way drawn out of the healthily constituted human being. We will see that certain points can be established. By these means, it will be possible to distill from the eurythmical discipline a healthy and therapeutic discipline. It is possible to transform certain artistic forms in one direction or another to become what can be called a eurythmy therapy. It will be essential, of course, to emphasize that artistic eurythmy, which essentially expresses that element inherent in the formation and tendencies to movement of the human body, is that which has to be deemed correct for the development of the human organism as soul, spirit, and body, just as it is appropriate for visual presentation. Yet it is also possible to work toward a eurythmy therapy that will be of extensive use in treating various chronic and acute conditions. It will prove to be especially important and pertinent in those specific cases of impending illnesses and tendencies to illness, which we attempt to treat prophylactically through eurythmy. Here is the point at which the educational element in eurythmy flows gradually over into a healthy and therapeutic activity. However, for those who wish to practice artistic eurythmy, I want specifically to emphasize that when they do artistic eurythmy, they will have thoroughly to forget what they have gained from these present sessions. Precisely in this area, we have to maintain a strict separation between those goals which we pursue in health and therapy and that artistic quality which we have to strive to attain in eurythmy. Anyone who persists in mixing the two will first of all ruin his/her artistic ability in eurythmy, and secondly, find him/herself unable to achieve anything of importance in respect to its healthy and therapeutic element. Apart from this, it will be necessary to acquire some physiological knowledge, which will transform itself into a feeling for the processes forming the human organism, in order to apply the healthy and therapeutic side of eurythmy practically, as we will see in the following lectures. After these prefatory remarks, I would like to speak more specifically about what may be considered the basis for human eurythmy itself, since it appears to me to be pertinent to the goals we wish to attain. If you wish to understand what eurythmy is in its various aspects, you have first of all to understand the human larynx. We will come to know the other human vocal organs precisely through the series of our exercises relating to the larynx. But the first thing we must obtain will be a certain knowledge of the human larynx and its importance generally for the human organization. There is a much too strong tendency to regard each human organ as a thing unto itself, but that isn't the case. That is not how a human organ lives. Every human organ is a member of the whole organization, and at the same time a metamorphosed variation of certain other organs. Basically, every self-contained human organ is a metamorphosis of other self-contained human organs. Nevertheless, The case is that certain human organs and groups of organs prove to carry this metamorphic character more exactly within them, more precisely, I would like to say, and others less precisely. The larynx is one organ where you can penetrate through into the essence of the human organism, solely through properly understanding metamorphosis. Recall from your anatomical and physiological knowledge how uniquely the human larynx is formed. What I wish to convey can only be grasped through a Goethean contemplation of the human larynx. You will see that it is possible, if you make the effort to attain this Goethean contemplation of the organs involved, to which we will now direct our attention. Taking the larynx initially as an upward-directed extension of the windpipe, and studying its forms, you will discover that it may be characterized as a reversed, a from front to back reversed, piece of the human organism. From another place, another piece of the human organization turned around. Picture to yourself the back of the human head, including the auricular parts, and regard what you are picturing to yourself as the back of the human head, including the auricular parts, insofar as these are localized in this part of the human being, excluding the frontal lobe for the moment, and extending downward, so that it becomes the human rib cage with its vertebra, including the beginnings of the ribs, which have the much softer breastbone to the front, that lower down falls away altogether. Picture to yourself this less clearly defined system of organs that I have presented to you. The posterior part of the head, including the auditory parts, broadening out into the rib cage below. Think now of this part somewhat transformed. Imagine the diameter of the ribs greatly reduced. Imagine that which is very wide in the ribs, in the rib cage, here transformed into a pipe, the bony material being changed into cartilage. Imagine that part, which I isolated as the head, to be filled out in such a way that the less well-filled out parts of the head, those parts with empty spaces, were filled up. And then that which is now filled in with thicker tissue were left out. Think of that which in the head is actually filled with a liquid solid mass as replaced. Imagining the transformation of these parts of the human organism, you have the metamorphosis of the larynx, the posterior head with the attached rib cage reversed. The upward extension into the larynx is truly a sort of posterior head transformed. It is actually so. The etheric formative forces of the larynx bring about an inversion when compared with the formative forces of the above-mentioned part of the posterior head with the attached rib cage. Considering the matter etherically, we carry with the larynx, in our chest, in a manner of speaking, a second human being. He certainly, in a rudimentary, stunted manner, yet in his dispositions, in his stunted beginnings, is nevertheless at a certain stage of development. If what I have just described to you were to be returned to its former position, so as to appear as the posterior head, then in accordance with the formative forces, it would of necessity add on those parts of the forebrain. The tendency to build on something similar is also present in the larynx. The larynx has for this reason the thyroid gland in its vicinity. What appears in more recent physiology as the peculiar conditions of the thyroid can be understood in metamorphosis if you can see a kind of decadent forebrain in the thyroid. Readers aside, and there's a diagram here. I know this is very complicated. End of reader's aside. This performs functions taken over from the forebrain, when someone speaks. The thyroid must cooperate with the frontal lobe. If the thyroid is in any way diseased, you can easily imagine what sort of conditions arise. Simply because he possesses a thyroid, the human being is organized to use it as an organ of thought, related more to his chest nature. What I have designated as etheric formative forces, which work to bring into being this second human being, who takes up a counterposition in us, these etheric formative forces are actually very differentiated. When we breathe and this breathing expresses itself in speaking or singing, when this modified breathing, for from a certain point of view one must call it that, lives as speech or song, then that whole system of human organs, which I have already indicated as the posterior head continuing down into the chest, is in such inner movement that this movement experiences its reflexes in the organization of the larynx. So, we are to picture to ourselves that this whole system, together with the ear, is nothing other than a larynx, only metamorphosed. There is a forebrain. This whole system calling forth certain effects, which are reflected. Thus our larynx performs eurythmy toward the back, in the form of forces, what we think, feel, and so on. This eurythmy really goes on within us. Our larynx eurythmizes. The task is to return that which arises sensory, supersensory through the reflex action of the larynx to make it visible. Our arms express that which has already been relayed forth and back again. We are dealing here with something taken directly from the human organism. We have to make it clear to ourselves that we are drawing attention to that organ which has been set into the rhythmic system like an additional head with a downward extension. Our ordinary head, the more or less thoughtful head, tends to quiet down what pulses up rhythmically into it through the arachnoidal cavity, which is an extension of the breathing. It is by means of the transformation into rest of the movement coming from below into the rhythmic system. Thinking is conditioned by virtue of the fact that a state of balance is reached and stasis is developed out of elements in movement, reciprocally conditioning each other in motion, through a static situation arising in the head out of the dynamic situation. The reverse is also true. What we develop in the rest, in the stasis of the head, influences the dynamic of the rhythmic man, initially in a retarding manner. The fact is that an unnatural exertion of the soul and spirit in connection with the head tends to slow down the circulation. A further consequence is that chaotic or sloppy thinking transforms the rhythmic into the arrhythmic. It changes the natural rhythm which should play in the human rhythmic system into arrhythm, even into an anti-rhythm when it comes to full expression. If you wish to understand the human being, you have to observe the connection between the circulatory and respiratory system and careless, chaotic thought, as well as logical thought. Logical thinking, as such, carries within it the tendency to slow down the rhythm, to make it heavier. Logical thought has the peculiarity of falling out of rhythm. Consequently, the soul life that wishes to fall into rhythm will try to supersede logic by attempting to frame sentences and verses that follow in their course not the syntax, but the rhythm. By striving to return to rhythm in poetry, by resisting the enemy of poetry, that is prose, with the exception of rhythmical prose, of course, you are trying to become more human. I am not claiming that through logic one's development will tend more toward animalism. If you wish, you can always imagine that you evolve toward the angelic level. But in striving to turn from the logical to the human, you are trying to bring into the succession of the syllables and their movement, into the movement of the sounds and into the sentence structure, not what is demanded by the syntax, but that which the rhythm requires. We pay heed to the rhythmic man when wanting to return to the realm of poetry. We listen to the head man when wishing to enter into prose. This will serve to indicate the connection actually existing between that manifest part of man which I have described and that part which, as a metamorphosis of it, is somewhat concealed. He is there within us, however, this eurythmist who, as the etheric body of the larynx, performs a distinct eurythmy, intimately connected with the normal development of our respiratory system, with our whole circulatory system, and, naturally, through the intermediary of the circulatory system, even with the metabolic system, as you can surmise from all that I have presented. Now, all possible sorts of occasions arise for this very complicated arrangement, this dovetailing of a forward-oriented and a backward-oriented system, to become disjointed. It would be accurate to say that this is properly knit together only in very few people in today's culture. It will be necessary to develop a certain ability to observe this. When the head system, for example, has been so dealt with in childhood that the transgression against the rhythmic system is too great, everything possible can develop in later years simply through an irregularity in what I have described. This is precisely because in the case of the human organism, as in an avalanche, small provocations may build up great effects. In observing children from this aspect, you will find that it is extremely significant to what degree their unconscious living in rhythm predominates in their soul life over the quieting element of the head organization. For example, if this is the case, if the rhythmic system predominates, you must ask yourself whether something should not be introduced into the education of the child. If in time the condition appears to be habitual, then something must be done. When, as a result of the anomaly to which I have drawn attention, the child becomes increasingly excited, ever more and more fluttery, and nothing can be done with him, you must attempt to bring an iambic element into his whole organization. This can be done by having the child move in such a manner that, in full consciousness, for that he must receive your guidance, he moves first the left arm and the left hand forward, then the right arm, so that this becomes more conscious. The child is aware that is the first and was the first. Throughout the entire exercise, the consciousness must prevail. That was the first, and remains the first. It began with the left. One can reinforce the whole affair by having the child walk, stepping out with the left leg, and bringing the right leg up to it, so that the leg and foot exercise is added to the hand and arm exercise, but only to reinforce. This can be practiced tomorrow in connection with something else. The arm exercise is really the essential thing. If one has the child practice in this iambic manner, as one may call it, one will see that the exercises will calm the fluttery child, the excited child, and so on, provided they are continued over a sufficiently long period of time. Out of your knowledge of eurythmy, you could describe it like this. You have the child do half an ah with the left arm, and then complete this half ah to a whole ah with the right arm, and so on, so that the child remains in motion and the ah does not come into being all at once, but as the result of successive movements. If, on the other hand, you have a child who is phlegmatic, who doesn't want to take things in, our Waldorf teachers know these children well, they can at times bring one to a mild despair, these children actually hear nothing of what one says to them. Everything passes them by. In this case, one would do well to treat this child trochaically, that is to say, in just the opposite manner. Naturally, one cannot begin with everything all at once. This is an element which has yet to be brought into Waldorf education. You form the ah so that the child knows first the right arm, then the left arm, right arm, left arm, and then further that first the right leg is placed in front and the left leg brought up to it. Thus one has the arm movements forming the ah one after the other, reinforced by the leg and foot movement. Pay particular attention that these things are done in such a way that they live in the child's consciousness, so that the child is really aware. On one occasion, the left arm was the first. On the other, the right arm was the first. You will find that these things present difficulties for an inner understanding, for someone who in every way is a physiologist in the modern sense, believing that man's whole soul life is mediated through the nervous system. That is, those who do not know that feeling is mediated by the rhythmic system, the will by the metabolic system, and that only thought formation is mediated by the nervous system. If you do not know these things, you will have great difficulty in grasping the significance of what happens in any part of the body, both in respect to the soul and spirit part and to the bodily part of the human being. The person who has developed an ability to observe knows that when a person makes clumsy hand and finger movements, and so on, he will exhibit a particular manner of thinking as well, that can be compared with what happens in the fingers. It is really extremely interesting to study the connection between the manner in which a person controls the mechanics of the arm and the finger physiognomy with the way he thinks. For the qualities of soul and spirit which a person portrays proceed from the whole human being, not solely from the brain and nervous tissue. We have to learn to understand that we think not only with the brain, but with the little finger and the big toe. There is a certain significance in achieving lightness, particularly in the limbs, as this will bring lightness into the soul life as well. These ideas will only become applicable, as we shall see in the following lectures, when we are given the possibility of providing a truly complete school hygiene to accompany the other teaching. It can happen, for example, that a child is peculiarly unable to comprehend geometrical figures. He cannot understand a geometrical figure by looking at it. However difficult it may be, you will do this child a great service by making him take a small pencil between the big toe and the next toe and write really proper letters. That is something which carries a specific significance and which points in a fully justified manner to an interrelationship in man. Especially in the case of children, one may notice that the three members of the human organization do not, as it were, click properly into one another. A really large part of the anomalies of life are due to this improper articulation. To begin with, children experience headaches. At the same time, one notices that the digestion is disturbed, and so on. The most varied conditions may appear. We will give further indications in this regard in conjunction with other exercises to be shown in the next days. However, when confronted with a situation such as I have described, you can achieve a great deal with the child or children through having them do the following exercise. A eurythmical E, as you already know, a eurythmical A, and a eurythmical O. but so that the children do the yi with the whole upper body. For our physician friends, I want to emphasize particularly that what is essential in eurythmy, and that through which one achieves what is essential in artistic eurythmy as well, is not the mere form of the limb in position, seen from without, but that which comes into being when the stretching or the bending within the positioned limb is felt. What is felt in the limb is what is important. Assume that you do an E with both arms. This E will not appear as it should when seen from without if you observe only its line, its content as a form. You must feel concurrently. You can tell by looking at the person that he feels the stretching power in the E as he does it. Similarly, when a person does, for example, an A, the important thing is not that he does this, crosses the arms, but that he feels, here, one limb comes to rest on the other. In this feeling of one limb on the other lies the A in reality. What you see is the expression for this sensing of one limb through the other. Then, what you do here is no different from what you do when you look. You are continually carrying out an A by crossing the axis of the right eye with the axis of the left, in order to find a point, and so arrive at a crossing. That is actually the primal A. What has been demonstrated here is basically an imitation of it. Yet everything in man is a metamorphosis, and this is a perfectly justifiable imitation. As in speaking A, the larynx carries out in the etheric exactly the same form to the rear. When you practice this exercise with a child, it is necessary that the E be done with the upper body, that is to say, the child stretches out his upper body. He feels the whole body stretched. He does the ah with his legs, and the o by moving his arms like this. Readers aside, Steiner is, showing the E-A-O exercise, and he has those letters written here, but there's no mention of it. End of readers aside. Have the child do the following as quickly as possible in sequence. Stretch the upper body vertically. Separate the legs. And do the O movement with the arms. Release and repeat. Release and repeat. And so on. One can practice such a thing with the children in chorus, of course. However, in principle, such exercises should not be practiced with the children as a class. Artistic eurythmy and the eurythmy for educational and instructive reasons should be done by a class as a whole, for here the children of the same age belong together. In order to make the transition from the usual class eurythmy to these matters related to health-stimulating and therapeutic eurythmy, in order to practice with them, one must take those children who need such an exercise out of various classes, due to the peculiarities which I have described, the disharmony of the three members of the human organism. One can take them out of the most varied classes and then practice this exercise with these particularly suited for it. That really must be done if one truly wishes to pursue a eurythmy for health, a therapeutic eurythmy in the school. Thus we are already on the path, which, as we follow it further, will lead us to study certain movements that are actually only metamorphoses of the usual eurythmical movements, and to trace their effect on the human organization. The fact is that we have interior organs with certain forms. These forms may be subject to anomalies. The form of each organ stands in a certain relationship to a possible form of movement of the outer man. So the following may be said. Let us assume that some organ, let's say the gallbladder, tends toward deformation, a tendency to assume an abnormal form. A form of movement exists which will counteract this tendency. Such is the case with every organ. It is in this direction that we intend to develop what will follow. What I have given today was meant as an introduction to guide you to the path leading to this subject. The end of Lecture 1.